Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 320 of the Fun with Cars Motorsports Podcast, or episode 7 of 2022. I'm Robin Warner, and I'm joined by the man who is working on a Lewis Hamilton biopic pitch, Christopher Roche. Hey, Chris.
Hey there, Robin. Yeah, Lewis said he's up for it now.
That's exactly right.
Success of King Richard, although we'll gloss over the Oscars fiasco.
Well, I was wondering who you were going to slap to get the attention, but, you know, maybe you have your own approach. And I'm curious, now I read that you want to write and direct this biopic, but did you also wanted to star in it? Did you want to be Lewis Hamilton's mother? I mean, what role did you see for yourself?
Oh, I'm just going to do all the stunt driving, Robin. That's going to be my role.
Right. Cheers. Yeah, you can wear a yellow helmet just like anybody, can't you?
Well, and I can drive extremely quickly, of course.
Of course.
You don't know yet, because we've never raced together, but one day it might happen.
Yeah, I can't imagine you're more than a quarter second of lap slower. It is Wednesday morning, April 6th, and Chris and I are going to talk about the 12 hours of Sebring and other racing news. But first, Chris, I have a correction.
Oh, fantastic. A new pod segment.
Yes,
what are we correcting this week, Robin?
From last episode, and sort of quasi correction from the corrections. So we're going to keep that train going as well. Last episode, I said that it was episode 319 or episode 5 of 2022, and that was incorrect. Last episode, of course, was episode 6. So there. And this is more of a clarification than a correction. We talked about my correction last time and how Juan Pablo Montoya won it before Gilles Deferrin. He was 1999 champion. And you mentioned Dario Franchitti, and I said, no, Dario Franchitti, all his stuff came after Sebastian Bourdais. Well, that's not exactly true. So I thought I would add some clarification here. So Juan Pablo Montoya won the Champ Car Championship in 1999. That part is absolutely right. But Dario Franchitti and JPM scored the same number of points in that season. JPM won the championship because of having more wins in the season, so he won the tiebreaker. So that's why all of Franchitti's titles came later. Now, Franchitti went on to win 4 IndyCar championships, 2007 and then 2009 through 2011. So he won 3 in a row between 2009 and 2011. Now, if you'll remember the first correction, I said that Sebastian Bourdais won Champ Car 2004 through 2007. That is also true. Dario Franchitti's first championship in 2007 was the Indy Racing League, and Sebastian Bourdais' last championship was Champ Car. So the two series reunited in 2008, and then it was one championship from that point forward, but it was both Sebastian Bourdais in Champ Car and Dario Franchitti in IndyCar that won championships in 2007. And fun fact, this is a neat one. Officially, what was called the Champ Car World Series only existed in terms of full season racing between 2004 until 2008 before the season started. So they had 4 seasons. So you could say that Sebastian Bourdais won every single Champ Car World Series championship that ever was. There's a fun one.
So quick question. So for anyone who was listening intently and have spotted any mistakes, should they write in? Is there a prize?
The prize would be that you would get a mention in what I'm sure will be many corrections going forward. Because, man, oh, man. Yeah, I'm quasi hoping that this streak ends. But actually, one of our most loyal longtime listeners, Craig the Kilt Wilson, as he is known lovingly, asked if there was going to be another correction. And I said, I think there will be. So we'll see. We'll see if Mr. Kilt wants another correction. And if you do, sir, please feel free to find one of the many mistakes I make, and I'll correct it.
Speaking of Dario, I was always a big fan of Dario. Good racer. It was a shame when his career came to an end through the accident.
It
was 2007. He's back doing historic racing, amongst other things. And he works with Gordon Murray, actually, on some of his crazy new cars. But Dario,
there are worse gigs to have than that. Jeez.
Exactly. Yeah, he's a pretty good life, I think, all in all, Mr. Franchitti. But he is a closet Jimmy Johnson fan and was making a statement that he thinks Jimmy will soon come good. So there's quite a few out there. I think there must be some sort of self-help group that are all, you know, wannabe Jimmy Johnson success in IndyCar fans. So,
and I'm sure it's just pure coincidence that Dario Franchitti was a Chip Ganassi driver for several years.
Yeah, I'm sure that is completely coincidental. So just a little tidbit there. So shall we talk some Formula One?
Yes, please do. Let's talk about Formula One and the United States.
Well, first of all, I did note a couple of quite humorous April Fool's jokes. My favorite was Mazepin to Ferrari replacing Carlos Sainz for next year. and that Gasly was confirmed back at Red Bull for 23 as well. And that Daniel Ricciardo might retire at the end of the season.
I'm sure that Gasly thought that was hilarious.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. I think everyone found it hysterical apart from those named in the jokes. So, but never mind. I'll appreciate the attempt at humor. Yes, US. 3 Grand Prix from 2023.
Two of the three in parking lots. I mean, okay, I should say that Las Vegas is not supposed to be a parking lot, but it probably includes one, and it probably morph into mostly one. I'm highly suspicious.
So yes, it'll be a Saturday night race down the Las Vegas Strip, where nobody drunk will wander onto the circuit at any point for sure.
It's a very religious, prudent Protestant group, us Americans. Very sober group, especially in Vegas. Lots of churches.
The track layout looks like a typical street course in America, doesn't it? Really, it's punctuated by straights and right hand bends, so not a whole lot they could do, really. I guess they have some ideas to make it a little bit different. I was hearing about some plans to make the pit lane particularly interesting. I don't know about you, but that's not really what makes me tune into Formula One races. Is the unusual nature of the pit lane. But anyway, I mean, whatever they can come up with to give it a unique complexion will be.
I hear that when you pit is going to be governed by slot machines. So the team owners all have slots, and whoever gets a jackpot first gets to buy a pit stop. I think that's how it's going to go. But don't worry, they're all going to get free drinks while they play. It's totally going to be a good time.
So we have talked in the past about 40 years ago when Formula One was back at Las Vegas, 81 and 82, in the Caesars Palace car park or parking lot.
I thought it was the 90s, but that was Dallas, not Vegas, wasn't it? I probably
Phoenix,
mixing up
yeah,
Dallas.
Phoenix it was.
Well, there was Phoenix and Dallas sometime in
and
there.
And Detroit as well.
Well, Detroit, I remember, because that was there was downtown Detroit, and I don't think Formula One ever went to Belle Isle, but that one I know a little bit better. I think that was here comes. I'm setting
here
up
comes
for
the
next correction,
folks.
Yeah, I think it was like 88 to 90 or somewhere in there.
Yeah, I remember certainly they were. I missed the Detroit GP phase. I hadn't really got into Formula One by that time frame, but I do remember watching races in Phoenix and being, you know, fairly surprised at how dull the track was. But let's go back to 81 and 82, because I actually thought I would take the time to view some of the great YouTube videos that are out there of the races. You can watch clips of both Grand Prix. You know, the track layout is hysterical. I mean, it really is as terrible as you might imagine being in a parking lot. and the footage, you know, it just does look really dusty and sort of Heath Robinson-like, but, you know, with the Vegas sort of backdrop. But it is well worth having a look at. I mean, the first thing that shocks you are the cars. The cars just look so different to a modern F1 car because they're this is the middle of the underbody phase. So
yeah, I was going to say this was just after the Lotus 79 dominated in 78.
Exactly. So ground effect is in its full pomp. So a lot of the cars aren't even running front wings, which looks very strange. And
interesting.
And the drivers are very forward biased, so their feet are sort of forward of the front axle. So the cars seem sort of very long and the driver too far forward. They look a little bit odd until you get used to them. And then, you know, considering it was in a parking lot, there's some good racing. I mean, in the 82 race alone, there's a great De Cesaris Lauda battle that goes on for quite a few corners and is, you know, far more interesting than some of the DRS passes that we get these days. There's a sensational moment in 81 where Patrick Tombay, we don't see the crash, but he's lost the entire front end of his car and his feet are sticking out. They're completely in free air. Wow. And he just sort of climbs out through the front of the car. So it just reminds you how dangerous the cars were back then and why the drivers were pushed back behind the front axle in subsequent regulations.
If you don't have it in front of you, I completely understand, but I didn't KK Rosberg win one of those events? I thought that he was one of the Las Vegas victors.
Yeah, in 82, you basically have, it was the season finale, so you basically had the fight for the championship. And it's a pretty good battle, actually, between Rosberg and notably John Watson, who does his best to try and pinch it at the death. But it's just a great trip down memory lane. I mean, that race in 82 was won by Michele Alboreto in a Tyrrell, you know, one of the great storied race teams of the 70s and into the 80s. And then Watson was in a McLaren. You had Eddie Cheever, a great American racer.
Absolutely.
Racing in a Ligier. We had Rosberg driving a Williams. Ferrari were the Constructors' Champions that year. But, you know, it's a great lineup. We had Alan Prost, Lauda, Derek Warwick, Nigel Mansell, Derek Daly. I mean, people have will know that name who follow IndyCar
these days. Was Jody Scheckter still in the car? Because he was 79 champion, right?
I can't say for certainty, and I don't want to force you into correction, but I didn't come across his name when I was looking at the racing. I think he'd retired by then. But yeah, Nelson Piquet, Mario Andretti was out and about. So yeah, it's a good chuckle going back. If you got spare 10 minutes, go and watch some of those YouTube videos. They're a lot of fun.
Well, I'll be sure to put at least one of them in the show notes put up on Fun with Cars, so you can find at least one of them there.
Yeah, I would go with the 82. Definitely for the De Cesaris Lauda battle.
Fair enough. There it is. So what about this event gives you encouragement, if anything? Because I will be the skeptic. I will be the old curmudgeon saying, why can't they go to the Great American Racetracks? Good friend of the show, Jamie Price, pointed out in a tweet that even if Formula One went to one of our great tracks, they would then immediately ruin that track by forcing 100 different changes on it. And, you know, take away the character of the original thing in the first place. I think internally everyone knows that modern Formula One just can't be at the great places that United States has, which is why so many drivers in IMSA and IndyCar celebrate American racing, because it doesn't have so much sanitization that Formula One kind of forces these days. All that considered, what if anything, makes this look like it could be appealing to you?
Well, look, I think given the newfound popularity of Formula One in the United States, I think it's great that we're getting another Grand Prix. You know, three races a season hopefully will improve accessibility. I mean, particularly, you know, Vegas is a fairly cheap and easy place to fly to. There'll be an abundance of decent accommodation right next to the track. Which will make it very convenient. Hopefully, the ticket prices themselves will be fairly sensible. So, if you're an F1 fan that wants to go and sample or try or just see F1 on a regular basis, this may be a very good opportunity to do that. I mean, personally speaking, of the three tracks, Austin will remain by far my favorite, I would prioritize going to that one over Miami or Vegas. But, you know, more options, more chances to see F1 here is got to be a good thing. And, of course, for North America, we have Montreal back, and we'll have the Mexican Grand Prix as well. So that gives us five races in North America, which is starting to get up to where it should be compared to, you know, the number of races that are held in Europe still. As far as the layout itself and you know, how the race weekend's going to run, I mean, I'm okay with a little bit of experimentation, and I'm okay with them. Sounds like they're going to make a lot of effort to make the track as good as it can be while maximizing the location. So the intent seems positive, and I'm open-minded. We'll have to wait until we see a couple of races there. But to me, it's all largely positive for U.S. fans of Formula One.
Here's my biggest concern is how much the local Las Vegas government and in turn the people of Las Vegas are going to react to this, because there will be at an absolute minimum a sizable minority of non-racing enthusiast people that want to go to Vegas to do Vegas things, and they will be none too pleased when this happens. So how is the local Las Vegas government and the Las Vegas businesses going to work around that part of that, where people do not want to be a part of this but do want to be right on the strip to consume copious amounts of calories and mindlessly slot coins into flashing light machines like zombies? I am impartial, as you can tell.
Well, look, I think if you're at the Bellagio or whatever, and you're, you know, deep into the casino tables, you won't know that there's even an F1 race going on, will you? I mean, you can't even tell if it's night or day. There's no clocks. They've set the whole system up so you can gamble to your heart's content and not have to leave the hotel or complex at any time. So I think, you know, of any city that can cope with this type of disruption, it'll be Vegas. I can't imagine the deals being signed without local government support. And, you know, it's all about driving numbers and you know, tourists to visit the casinos to spend their money. So I don't think that's going to be a huge impediment. I mean, I don't know logistically if it's going to stop you enjoying the sights of, you know, the fountain or the Eiffel Tower or whatever while the F1 cars are going
on.
I mean,
call it the Eiffel Tower, for heaven's sakes.
The Pyramids of Giza. I mean,
well, briefly, there's the Paris Casino, and it has a replica Eiffel Tower, which is not as big as the real thing, but it's actually a lot closer than you think. It's about half size. So it goes up 500 or so feet.
I'm very disappointed.
The real one is about
1,000
feet.
Surely everything in America is supposed to be bigger. They should have gone twice as large, not half the size. What were they thinking?
Yeah. You're right. Maybe that one, property values in Vegas are high enough that was a limitation, perhaps. But it's if you've been to the real thing, which I'm very lucky to say that I have. Obviously, this completely pales in comparison, but it is a lark to have it right there surrounded by a bunch of other buildings. I will give them that. They get lark credit.
Well, but you've got the pyramids, at least one pyramid anyway. And then you've got Venice. I mean, it's just a wonderful place to see the sights and
yeah,
sounds of the
yeah,
world.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
just
you can
one
tour
gambling
the world
mecca.
Just by going down one street. Exactly. With the 120-ounce margarita in your hand in a cup that's shaped like the Eiffel Tower, or maybe it's a daiquiri. Either way, it's just good, wholesome fun.
So you'll be signed up then. You'll be going next year, will you?
Oh yeah, sure. I'm gonna be there. I'm gonna be there for weeks on end just for the buildup of it. It's gonna be exciting.
Yeah, I think there's reasons to be cheerful about this, Robin. And if you're not a huge fan of Vegas or the track at Vegas, then, well, just go to Austin instead, because some of the people who would have gone to Austin are now going to Vegas. So there'll be more room for those who prefer a more traditional.
Now there is a
setting.
Silver lining that we've got. I like that. Yeah, no, of course, Austin is much closer to my heart in terms of true motorsport happening in the United States. A track built to Formula One specifications from the ground up, from the beginning, catering to Formula One so that it can be built to those specs and yet still have some character left. You know, Sector 1 is properly cool. You know, I've gone, you know, 80 miles an hour average speed through Sector 1 in a Stelvio Quadrifoglio SUV. So, you know, the fact that I can do 80 or so in that just gives you a sense of just how fast, how utterly insanely quick it is through a Formula One car. So there's that. You've got a kilometer long straightaway, slightly over kilometer long straightaway. Between, is it 11 and 12, turn 11 and 12? Sorry, we don't have names. We have numbers. We are logical here in the United States. And a lot of interesting things. You know, turn 18, that like quad apex, big, massive sweeper. There's a lot of things about Texas that I can get behind.
I'm going to interrupt you there. You're wrong. The names of the corners are after different McDonald's menu items.
Don't tell me that now. That's for corrections next episode.
So number 11 is a double cheeseburger meal. That's what that corner's called.
Now, here's the truth of the matter. There is a very good chance that what Chris is saying is accurate, and he would have a better chance of knowing than I would, even though I'm the big, fat, dumb American, and he is an honorable English gentleman.
Those are your words, mate, not mine. I don't know what you're talking about, but the other thing I will say, if we could move on momentarily, is I am a little disappointed because there were rumors that Roger Penske was talking about trying to bring Formula One back to Indianapolis.
Yes, that was talked about, yes.
And I was quite excited about that, despite being one of the attendees of the six-car Grand Prix that was held there. I did actually enjoy that venue in years prior to that rather notorious race. And although the track, again, isn't really perfect for a modern Formula One car, it's still a really, you know, obviously it's an iconic venue and the races were always, you know, really good fun, and there was overtaking without DRS possible. And so I was hopeful that we might have an easily commutable Midwestern Grand Prix. So I don't know if Vegas being announced and put on the calendar is going to scupper those plans for a Midwest Grand Prix or not, or whether we'll have a fourth race, which, hey, why not? Just keep adding them.
Yeah.
It can become like the F1 IndyCar series.
Yeah, well, I would certainly applaud them going back to Indianapolis for personal and just general reasons. I think your point about it being an iconic track is a good one, but also, you know, it was a unique spot where they could be full throttle for over 20 seconds just on it. And the speed,
if you're on Bridgestones, yep.
The speeds they reached were quite high, you know, well over 200 miles an hour. And it was painfully flat, except for the banking, but it was still an interesting course that did bring, as you say, pre-DRS passing. And also, the sound being within that super speedway stadium,
yep.
The sound and the echo and the reverberation was insanely good. I mean, that was just such a fantastic thing to experience. And for the sound alone, I would love it. Even in this hybrid era, it probably wouldn't be as good as the V8s I heard, because I went a year or two afterwards. I went to the 2007 a USGP in Indianapolis, and that sound was just incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I went to, what, I must have gone to three or four while it was on, and I enjoyed every visit apart from the six-car race, which I left in protest after two laps. But, you know, that was a slightly different matter. A modern Formula One would, of course, find a solution to those problems that they encountered that particular year. But yeah, I mean, we'll have to wait and see. I mean, Roger's a pretty persistent chap, so maybe he hasn't, you know, there's still maybe plans afoot. We'll have to see what the rumours are. Now Vegas is added to the calendar, so that means for other races over here. But
how many years is it guaranteed to be in Vegas? Because I know Texas that was announced as well, I believe, recently. Texas did sign an extension. So
yeah. I didn't see a commitment to the number of years in Vegas. I think, I don't know, we'll have to we'll have to find out. I don't think it was announced. I don't remember reading it anyway.
Yeah, something to keep an eye on anyway. Also, one thing I did want to briefly mention, Mercedes is going to bring updates into Australia. I think that will surprise absolutely no one. It sounds like people are hypothesizing it could be fairly significant, but a heavily redesigned rear wing at an absolute minimum is what's being talked about, as well as some modifications to adjust the tunnels on the floor as well.
That's right, and that will hopefully complement the redesigned Australian Grand Prix circuit, which is being changed for this year. So they've removed a chicane around the back and modified and reprofiled a few of the corners, hopefully to give us a slightly more flowing circuit. And Mr. Vettel will be back also for this race. So his first race of 22 in the Aston Martin. Now he's recovered from COVID.
Speaking of that, Nico Hülkenberg is saying he would love to be back for a full season of Formula One racing.
Ooh,
I don't think
that's a surprise.
I don't think that surprises anybody except for maybe Chris Roche. But it's like, well, duh, of course you want to be back for the full season. Do you think any team would seriously consider him?
Well, you know, the obvious name that comes to mind is we've seen what an upgrade Magnussen was. So why not upgrade Latifi for Nico Hülkenberg? He used to race for Williams. Maybe we just we put Latifi on a lovely Friday, you know, free practice one contract and let Nico do the rest of the weekend.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly in terms of pure driving talent, you can't argue with that. You know, Latifi, you know, he's we'll see how he gets going on by the end of the year. But first couple seasons have been a struggle, certainly.
I mean, maybe Lewis Hamilton will help fund that driver change. You know, it might help him in his championship conquest.
I certainly would not be upset if Hülkenberg made his way back into the sport, but I'm not going to put a lot of money on it. Since we're still kind of quasi on a Vegas theme, I'm not really to put a big bet on that.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't look like there's a lot of seats available, does it, at the moment? And I don't think we're going to have any new teams entering the sport anytime soon, because it's all gone very quiet on the Andretti F1 effort, hasn't it? So I think yeah, he's going to have to bide his time and hope a few more people catch COVID, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, only for Hülkenberg's sake would that be something I'd say yes to. So shall we move on? There was a big weekend of endurance racing that we haven't had a chance to talk about yet. It was same track, 2 days. On Friday, it was the 1,000 miles. Was it 1,000 miles or kilometers? Maybe kilometers.
Miles. It was miles, okay. So you don't have to correct it.
There you go. 1,000 miles for World Endurance Championship. And then on Saturday, it was the famous 12 hours of Sebring, and it was the 70th. 12 hours of Sebring, and Sebring back a long, long time ago was actually on the Formula One calendar. I do believe, oh man, I'm just begging for corrections now. I believe it was 1959 was the first year. But anyway, I said I believe. I didn't state it as a fact.
I think you're right. I think it's the right decade for sure. Definitely 50s.
We have believes and thinks. So we have... We have qualified it plenty, I think. Anyway, it was a great race, as it always is. I absolutely love that track. That is my favorite flat track in the world. There's no elevation change around Sebring, and yet it is epically entertaining. And it's because of the unique location, the pavement, the layout, all of it. I mean, the track is terrible, and that's what makes it great.
Well, for an endurance race, yeah, it's a stress on the word endurance there, isn't there? As the cars literally fall apart. I mean, in the proper 12-hour race, poor old Bourdais, who was on pole position, lasted, what, a lap before his car conked out?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Tough race for him. But, yeah, I mean, it was a good battle in DPI, wasn't it, with... Cadillac, well, you could argue sort of dominating, really, because the first place Acura was down in fourth. So
yeah, it was a Cadillac 1-2-3. So Cadillac had the entire podium, and it was led by Chip Ganassi Racing, and Earl Bamber in that car for the checkered flag.
Yeah, so clearly that car was working really, really well around that track. I did one of the things that caught my eye though was the young Sebastian Montoya behind the wheel.
Oh man, and he was quick too.
16 years old, and he was in a DPI car, right? So
I thought was it DPI? I thought it was an LMP2, but it may very well have been a DPI car.
Well, we could correct that next week, but
man, that'll be the whole episode.
But his father crashed it, sadly.
Well, okay, the race. Hold on, wait, pause there. So Juan Pablo Montoya was in the same car, and he was badly pinched. I mean, he was stuck between a rock and a hard place. He, another car, I think it was another DPR car, came out of the pits and like right into a string of cars. And that slowed and threw everything off, and then he ended up having to go outside to avoid a damaged car, and there were a bunch of GTD cars there that he was going much faster than, and tried to find a slot in the middle as best he could, but just couldn't. He got extremely unlucky.
You are making a good point there. I'm curious about Sebastian then. So obviously, he's got the right name. There's been a few champions, as we talked about before, in Formula 1 and
Wrong discipline,
and World
though.
Rally.
He should be in Rally, yeah.
Yeah. But so is he trying to have a single-seater career? Where does he normally race, or is he already a sports car racer?
I thought he was like Formula 3 or something, you know, maybe even Formula Ford. I mean, 16, you know, everyone other than our latest world champion wasn't in Formula 1 or close to it in 16. But, yeah, I'm pretty sure he's going through the European Formula ranks. But, I mean, that happens. I mean, Michael Schumacher did some sports car racing for Mercedes as he was ramping up into Formula 1. Mark Webber did some of that. I mean, it's not unheard of to just take seats where you can get them. High-profile event, get your name out there, get some attention.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually was lucky enough to be at Le Mans when Schumacher was racing. But I think if he's a chip off the old block, I'm pretty happy because I was a big JPM fan, more in his single seater days than his NASCAR days. But yeah, he was always a great, great racer. So if his son's anything like he was, then that's exciting for the future of racing, I think.
Yeah, Juan Pablo is just a fantastic personality. I mean, he was kind of quasi Kimi Räikkönen-ish before Kimi Räikkönen was really becoming famous for being Kimi Räikkönen. And then, but he's just a great personality. And he and I I interviewed him a few times when he came back to the States to do IndyCar yet again, and then IMSA afterwards. And we've had a few great conversations. So he's a great character, great guy, still incredibly quick. And to see a second generation Montoya is all for the good.
Definitely. So the one interesting thing for me was the Corvettes coming back and winning the Pro Class. Because they'd struggled at Daytona in the 24 hours and bounced back strongly in Sebring to win fairly comfortably, I think.
Yeah, I think you were a little bit more, if I remember correctly, you were a little bit more downtrodden about Corvette's performance than I was. The fact that they had to shift from GT Le Mans class to GTD Pro. You know, that's effectively building a new car all over again. And I think they just needed a race to get it sorted out. I mean, that was true of the BMW M4 versus last year having the GT Le Mans M8. So, BMW didn't favor quite as well at Sebring. But I think Corvette just needed a race to get their feet underneath them, get some testing under their belts. And to really get the car sorted, it's fundamentally just a fantastic car. So it's a mid-engine supercar in obtainable dollars as a street car. So to build a race car, you just have to get it sorted. It's going to be fantastic.
Yeah, but I mean. Credit to them for, I think it's Pratt & Miller that does the racing operation for GM with the Corvette. And they've been doing it for a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, credit to them for turning it around so quickly. I mean, it's been, what, less than 2 months since Daytona, so about 2 months. So, fair play. Come back and win second time out is no mean feat, I don't think.
Yeah, and Corvette beat, actually, Lamborghini and Mercedes. So it was not Porsche or Ferrari. In GTD Pro, it was Lamborghini and Mercedes that they had to edge out in that. And as you say, I think it was, at the end of the 12 hours, reasonably comfortable considering everything. So, definitely a good showing by them. And it's just a cool car, too, I think. I think it looks like a really good race car to me.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah.
So the WEC race wasn't quite so successful, was it? So they had a few issues with the 1,000 mile, which was, as you said, held earlier in the weekend. So it was supposed to run for about 8 hours, but they had to cut it short due to a storm. And they had a few red flags as well when one of the Toyotas had a big old chunk trying to lap a backmarker. That was for Lopez. The big news was Alpine got the win. Who would have thought that?
Yeah. I remember that. Toyota, that was a surprise. Second. Hey, it was not Toyota Gazoo. It was Alpine that won that race.
Yeah. So it seems like the root cause of that is the balance of performance. It seems like there's been a lot of changes to Toyota that weren't all very welcome. So more weight, less power, some aerodynamic tweaks, and they're not allowed to use their four-wheel drive system until they're doing 190 kilometers per hour.
What?
exactly.
They have to go. So it used to be 190 until it can be engaged. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So this is the hybrid power. Last season, they were able to deploy it at 120 kph, and now this season it's 190 kph.
Wow.
And basically that hybrid power,
I mean, that's 105, 106 miles an hour, I think. Am I doing the math right? Because
yeah, somewhere around that. No. So it's certainly over 100 miles an hour,
hold
right? Because 1.6 is the conversion factor. So
yeah,
you're probably about more like 115, I would think.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Corrections is going to be long next episode. we'll ramp up for that.
Yeah, 118 point, yeah, around 118
yeah,
miles
okay.
an hour.
So, good.
So, but the significance is that the hybrid power on the Toyota is deployed primarily through the front axle. So it basically allows them to get more traction. And now with this higher speed, it basically reverts them more to a rear wheel drive biased car. So that affects their tire wear and obviously, you know, how much power they can put down. So, you know, massive changes for Toyota. And obviously that played into Alpine's hands, who, you know, that car isn't a new one. It's been around for a while and was soundly beaten last season. So now it's a bit more competitive. And then with the Glickenhaus coming third, but seemingly some way behind. I think it was at least lapped once. So yeah, interesting. I think it's very controversial that you know, any series that has any performance equalizing metric, whether that's, you know, through weight or more sophisticated methods, is always a tricky one to follow. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out over the course of a season, and particularly when we get some of these new manufacturers like Ferrari, I think Peugeot and Porsche coming into the series, and, you know, if they build a good car, they're immediately slapped with a bunch of changes to pull them back. I think it's going to be very controversial. So I think this is going to run and run, but I don't think Toyota was that chuffed with being pushed into second place due to that. And then, of course, the other thing was the fact that they had to end the race early due to a storm. So I don't know, maybe the race would have been a closer finish. It was a 37-second margin of victory. It may have been closer if they hadn't ended the race earlier, potentially. But yeah, interesting times in the WEC, no doubt.
Yeah, certainly so. And, you know, this is leading up to a big shift where WEC and IMSA are going to have a stronger marriage in terms of classes and those things. This is the last year before that really starts taking place. So this is kind of like a fill-in year already. So to to have those kinds of things happen, that certainly doesn't help their cause. But yeah, so be it. We do have a lot of racing coming up, and it is big deal stuff here. We have the Australian Grand Prix coming this weekend, April 8th to the 10th. Also, a big race for IndyCar, the Long Beach Grand Prix, that's 8th to the 10th as well. And IMSA is also going to Long Beach. They're going to race on Saturday, and IndyCar races on Sunday. So their race is April 9th. So there's a big old pile of racing to watch this coming weekend. Good stuff.
We didn't talk much about IndyCar. You I think in a previous pod had stated who won the race with McLaughlin being just pipped by Newgarden at the finish of the XPEL 375. But the thing I hadn't registered immediately was just the domination of Penske and Ganassi. I mean, they took all top seven finishes. It was the Meyer Shank of VK that was the first non Ganassi Penske finisher in eighth place.
So not even an Andretti Autosport car.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm misreading my notes here. It was Paginau that got that eighth place in the Meyer Shank car. So VK qualified in eighth place. So I'll make the correction instantaneously. but yeah, I mean, the point that Penske and Ganassi just dominated on the oval is very interesting, and sort of, you know, Andretti was really struggling with Colton Herta being the first Andretti finisher in 12th place. So I remember Andretti didn't have a really strong 21. So I know they did all right in the opener in St. Pete, and Herta was fairly competitive there. But it will be interesting to see if there really is a shift in the power in IndyCar, really just to Ganassi and Penske, if it becomes more of a two-horse race rather than the three-horse race that we've been used to.
I certainly hope not. I can say that much. Real quick, it was Joseph Newgarden that won, Scott McLaughlin was second, Marcus Ericsson third, Will Power fourth, Scott Dixon fifth, Jimmy Johnson in sixth, Alex Palou in seventh, Simon Pagenaud finished eighth, Santino Ferrucci in ninth, and Rinus VK did finish 10th. And then on and on down the list.
Was Jimmy awarded a trophy for coming sixth?
might happen. We have to make one up yet, don't we? I think that's on us.
Yeah. I mean, it's not that surprising that he did all right on an oval, is it? 21, I would have thought. We'll have to see how he goes at Long Beach.
He didn't, you know, it's not like he was a front runner all race either. You know.
No.
You know,
he qualified 18th.
Yeah. So it's, you know, there's, yeah, it's not worth digging into too much, but it was, yeah. So, yes, but, you know, IndyCar racing on ovals, it just inherently is less interesting to me. Other than the Indianapolis 500, of course. But, you know, Long Beach, I'm very, very keen to see how that race pans out.
But to reinforce the point I just made earlier about Penske and Ganassi, I mean, the top six drivers in the standings come from those two teams at the moment. So there isn't a single driver outside of the Penske-Ganassi fold that's in the leading the standings at this point, or in the mix. In the top half dozen, so that's going to be something worth watching to see if we can see Andretti or some of the other team drivers get a bit more competitive as we move forward.
Yes, real quick though, we're two races into IndyCar, and in the first race it was Penske Ganassi again, but fourth place was Colton Herta. So you're right that this is a trend to see if it develops, but I think it's too early in the season to worry too much just yet.
Yeah, yeah. Grosjean didn't have the best of introductions to an oval, did he? He qualified 13th, which, I mean, that's respectable. But then went out in the race through no fault of his own. He had a mechanical failure. You know, we've seen road course drivers turn up and be super competitive on ovals immediately. I'm going back away here, but I mean, I was always stunned when Mansell rocked up in IndyCar in 93 and immediately was competitive on the ovals. And they used to have more ovals back in the 90s than they do on the calendar these days. But it'll be interesting to see how he goes, I think, on the ovals. I think there's four more this season. Hopefully he can get to grips with them.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but there is something that is more exciting than all of these things combined, Chris.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and that, of course, is my latest YouTube video. Come on.
Do you have a correction section in those two?
Oh, ouch. No. Should I?
No, of course not.
This one is on the 2022 Honda Civic Si. So it is a hot hatch in spirit, though it is a sedan. But it is a Honda Civic with 200 horsepower, 192 pound-feet of torque, a limited slip differential, obviously Spoiler-tuned suspension, and the one and only transmission is a six-speed manual transmission, and it is a very slick shifting six-speed manual transmission. So it's a great, great little car.
So hang on, this is both a non-SUV, CUV, and a manual. Wow, how did you unearth that, Jim?
I know, already it's a unicorn. But it's it's one of those rare things where everything just kind of aligned, and it's quite good.
Well, I love your the detail you put into your video. So I will go on record as saying that you always provide a fountain of information about the cars that you test, and a lot of very interesting comments and notes about the design or the performance or spec of the cars you're testing. So full credit to you for that.
Kind of you say so. Yes, I try to. I feel like I'm not doing my job if I don't. So it's fascinating. I hope that I do so in an entertaining enough way. That's the critical element, isn't it?
Absolutely. But so were you stymied at all with the third pedal, or did it just come back naturally?
It was like riding a bicycle, as they say. Although, ironically, I haven't rode a bicycle in a while, so I need to test that theory. But it came back naturally, and this poor car, you can tell that the clutch had been used and abused quite a lot. So it was jolly good fun, and I quite enjoyed myself, and it's definitely hopefully worth a watch.
A small digression before we proceed.
Yes.
My daughter's going through segment one here in Michigan to learn to drive. And she does quite frequently ask me which one is the brake and which one's the accelerator, which is slightly alarming, as she'll be driving me before too long. And so I just can't wait to add a third pedal to the mix.
Yeah, absolutely so. Yeah, and you can just name it as like, this is the good pedal, we call it the brake. It's the bad pedal, we call it the throttle or the gas or whatever you want to call it.
Maybe we should have them color-coded, you know, red, right. Red for the brake for stopping and green for the accelerator.
Right. You know, it's fascinating that it's, you know, whether you call it the gas or the throttle or whatever, slowly but surely that's no longer an appropriate name for it, because there's no throttle in electric vehicles. And quickly, more and more manufacturers finding ways to go without the throttle body, even on internal combustion engine cars. So it's interesting to see, like, they can, because they have so much more control over the valves, that a throttle in some engines isn't necessary. Do you see what I'm getting at? So more and more, I think we have to learn to just call it the accelerator pedal.
It's fine by me.
Well, there it is. We actually do have to, I have one more thing to say. We have to end on a really sad note, actually. Vic Elford passed away last month, and he was just a really fascinating individual. He's done all different kinds of things in motorsport in the big heyday of it. He was a rally driver. He was a Grand Prix driver. He drove a lot of Porsche 917s, and he was also just a fantastic person to have a conversation with. Episode 287 that we recorded last year was a nice long conversation with Vic Elford last year talking about his career in motorsport, and it was just a wonderful, wonderful conversation. So I highly encourage you to go back and re-listen to that in memoriam of the great Vic Elford.
Yeah, I'll second that. I loved the interview you did with him last year, and he had some wonderful stories and reminiscing about his storied career. So, yeah, poor old Vic, rest in peace.
Yes, rest in peace. And We will be back very soon to cover all these motorsports, all these race weekends coming up. But for now, Chris, great conversation.
Thank you, Robin.
I'm Robin Warner. Goodbye.